Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, welcome back after a 1 week hiatus. I had a great time resting. I'm your host today for Radio Free Kansas, Mike Cadell, broadcasting out of North Jefferson County, Kansas. Hope you enjoy the show today. Today we have John Grant, part of the Fab Four, running the incredible Workaran News Collective website, the new one, This Can't Be Happening. John Grant, be on here in just a little bit. First, I want to play some new music submitted by Brother Jim Herman out of Kansas City, Missouri. Actually, a guy, I guess he comes from down my neck of the woods, down there, southeast Kansas. He's removed himself from there. Now he's in Kansas City. He's also co-chair of the Kansas Progressive Caucus. He's a good musician. I'll play a couple of his songs to lead off. We'll get right to the interview with John Grant, recorded yesterday afternoon while it's still fresh. I hope you enjoy the show today. I'll read some local news in the second hour, play a half hour show, History Counts by Kevin McDermott Rowe. Outstanding quality 30 minute special with Michael Christopher Carroll, author of Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Germ Warfare Lab on Plum Island. I'll read some local news and developments about National Biological and Agro Defense Facility slated to be built on the campus of Kansas State University, Manhattan, Kansas. That'll be in the second hour. I'm going to go with one of my, I've listened to this, I really like it. Jim Herman, Corporate Kings.
Boston Tea Party was not about taxes. Don't you believe in? Here's what the facts is. Reason Sam Adams and Revere are so big is something that history teachers often have missed. See, the East India Company had debts to pay, so the king had been Parliament the far away. Cornered the market on the colonist tea, giving East India a monopoly. When a group of patriots fought for this nation to set us all free from kings and corporations, Washington, Jefferson, Sam Adams, Revere made a stand for failures as dear. Listen, we the people, we have the power to take on all injustice and make it right. We the people, this is the hour. Set aside all difference, we'll stand and fight. If history teaches anything, it's that we must resist corporate kings. Rockefeller, Carnegie Steel, American Tobacco, J.P. Morgan, Rail, Randolph first had the papers and opinions. They each had their union-busting minions. But a group of progressives fought for this nation to set us all free from kings of corporations. Teddy and the Muckrakers, Wilson and Taft, they busted up trunks and they all did one last. Listen, we the people, we have the power to take on all injustice
It won't be on the listeners. This is another rare treat from the News Collective, the new News Collective at thiscan'tbehappening.net. You all are very familiar with Dave Lindorf, who's regularly been on Radio Free Kansas. But today we have John Grant. And now, John Grant has an interesting history. He's a writer. I'm going to read from his bio here at the thing, and This Can't Be Happening. As a writer, photographer, filmmaker living just outside of Philadelphia, he's worked as a newspaper reporter and published both fiction and nonfiction. Started in the 80s, he traveled to Central America and other places as a documentary photographer for publication and for exhibits of his own large prints. He shot and edited an 80-minute documentary film called Second Time Around about a seriously wounded Vietnam veteran who chose to live and work in Ho Chi Minh City 35 years after his first tour there. John has been to Iraq twice during the war, once as an observer critical of the war and once as a cameraman on a documentary film. A Vietnam War veteran for 25 years, John has been active member of Veterans for Peace. Local listeners, you're familiar with the Veterans for Peace coming out of Kansas City, Missouri. For 11 years, he was president of the Philadelphia VFP, Veterans for Peace chapter. He's taught documentary photography at, I hope I get this name right, John, Widener and Drexel Universities. Yeah. And for 9 years has taught creative writing to inmates in the Philadelphia prison. Certainly, for me, I'm in the prison, in the warehouse of Kansas, struggling. I can use your help.
Right.
I've always tried to come up with some creative writing, John. I can't do it. Had writer's block for 10 years. I'm kidding. For 200.
Get them to do journalism in there. Get them to start their own radio show. That would be a
yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. We're leading into that because John recently published an article called The Battle Between the First and Second Amendments. And it really got my attention. I hung on every word, John. I'm not exaggerating. I really did. You know, could you give us overall? I'll try. It's this weird, horrible news about this cop, this Oakland, California cop. There's this one thing. Well, let me start with your topic sentence, and then you can help me. There is a contest going on in America between the First and Second Amendments as to which is more favor in our court system. It's a face-off between gun violence and freedom of the press, and it involves individuals, giant corporations, and standing armies, and that's not part of the journal press corps, folks. So, okay, well, help me out on this. This is
it has occurred to me as a working journalist who, you know, for an independent journalist, you know, I've worked on newspapers in life, but now I'm not connected to any major institution. But every time I go to cover something with the police involved, you know, I was treated as, you know, as if I was a demonstrator. In other words, and then when it came to the point of photographing people being arrested or what, you know, I was pushed around and slapped around and pushed out of the scene. Whereas, and I've seen a number of photographers who insisted on remaining, and they were arrested, and their ability to photograph or record this event was prevented, and then in one case here recently, she was then released, or charges were dropped just before she went to trial. So she, you know, they prevented her from recording the event. At the same time, they then precluded any stand she might make in court, saying her First Amendment rights had been infringed. So, you know, they got everything they needed, and it seems to me that I went, you know, that this was against the First Amendment, the spirit of the First Amendment,
mm-hmm.
Which says that, you know, about religion, speech, and the press, and, you know, that the abridgment of the press, there shall be no abridgment of the press. And it says here, Congress shall make no law respecting an established religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And it seemed that in that case, very much, they were prohibiting or restricting or controlling or stopping the free exercise of the press. And then I went back, and you know, as the in the Second Amendment comes up, this idea of original thought, you know, the original thought of the framers, the constructionalists, or what do they call them, the Scalia and the guys, the right-wing guys on the
Supreme
Court, that, you know, they want to see, well, what the framers intended. Well, when you look back at what the press, this idea of the press, in reality was at the time of the frame of the Constitution, 1787, it was a very small, very rudimentary thing, maybe 4 pages long, and it literally was done with a press, a physical press.
Well, you know, people, so, excuse me, John, that's all I print out here.
That's what it is.
Broadsheets.
Like and blogs are to what the press was in 1787, then certainly Rupert Murdoch's empire, or, you know,
so, right.
You know, original intent, let's get real here, you know? And so if they then on the Second Amendment, the Supreme Court, these right-wing Supreme Courts say, well, we want the original intent. The original intent of the Second Amendment was, you know, that every individual has the right to own a 15-shot Glock and you know, a street sweeper automatic shotgun and all this, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that's all argument. It talks about a well-regulated militia being necessary, that people have the right to bear arms. Well, it does talk about individuals, but it also, if you read about the what was going on in the time of the framing, that they were arguing, you know, between Washington and his desire for a standing army, which is, of course, what we have now ruling us, and the idea of militias, which was what people like Thomas Jefferson were favoring. Well, at the, you know, the standing army tended to win in the bulk of the Constitution. So at the end, Alexander Hamilton, as I've read, you know, put this amendment in, the Second Amendment, to, you know, as a sop to the militia people to say, look, okay, your militias will be covered. Don't worry, you'll have the right to arm yourself and all this. You know, so both of these amendments contain individual components and they contain institutional or corporate components of groupings, you know. And so it depends, you know, I just noticed that it seemed to me that the Supreme Court was emphasizing the individual component on the Second Amendment at the same time that it was crushing the individual component on the First Amendment. The idea of Joe, you know, any Joe Schmuck out there with a camera has the right to record things.
I'm going to play devil's advocate. Before I do that, I want
to
say, first off, I want
to
say, I'm glad Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton, okay? Let's get that straight. I read Gore Vidal's Burr, B-U-R-R, listeners, and you need to read that because you begin to get a clear explanation of why the man on the $20 bill deserved to be shot, okay? And but it's more than that because here you bring up Hamilton's name talking about this compromise on the militia issue of the Second Amendment. And then now you're bringing up the hypocritical stand, it seems, of the same Supreme Court members on the First Amendment.
That's my issue. And I must say here as a qualifier, I am not a lawyer, or I am not a judge, or I am not a Supreme Court constitutional scholar. I am just a blogster that. That's trying to up a little bit.
Well, we're doing that. But now, believe me, in Kansas, you are doing that at this very moment. Well, people are listening to you. But and I'm doing my best to stoke it. But look, you bring up an interesting the New Year's subway shooting. That's one of the things you bring up now.
Yeah.
And that news coverage going around it and the contradictions about. It's Oscar Grant, I believe, is who you're talking about.
Yeah, a 22-year-old black man in Oakland. It was New Year's morning, I guess, New Year's morning of 2009 in the Oakland subway. There was some altercation on the subway, and I guess the transit police were called, and it ends up with Oscar Grant and two other young men, I think, are sort of on the platform of the subway, sitting against the wall. They're very quiet, they're restrained, they've been, you know, sat there, and there's three cops. And what you get is, of recording of this, you get people, the train is apparently stopped, and you get people with their cell phones, the ever-present cell phone camera,
yeah, right,
with video on it, are sticking their cameras out the window, you know, just out of curiosity, filming with their little, you know, 30-40 second video capacity on these things. What's going on with this altercation between the police and these young black men? And so two people got some pretty interesting grainy video of this. What happens is you have two cops are taking this man, Oscar Grant, 22 years old, and taking him from a sitting position and forcing him down so his face is on the pavement, or, you know, the platform.
Mm-hmm.
One is at his head, and one is straddling him from behind. And I guess, you know, Grant is a rambunctious young man, and he doesn't like this. And he's rebelling in some way. But the guy then sort of raises up, you know, goes for his belt, pulls out a pistol, and pop, shoots him in the back. And at that point, the witnesses said, Grant said, you know, in sort of surprise, you shot me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, then he dies in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, the cop's defense is that he thought he was going for his taser gun, and he got the wrong item off his belt. Well, he had just, Grant, leaning against the wall moments before he's shot, had taken with his cell phone.
With his cell phone. He
his cell phone, a picture of the officer, a 27-year-old man, taking a picture of that officer pointing his taser gun right at Grant and his camera. So you have to then assume that this officer reholstered his taser gun in order to force Grant to put his face into the platform, and then, you know, he's going to go for his taser, but if you believe this, he went for the wrong item. And, you know, maybe he did. I noticed, in fact, the other day, I would say to my wife that he had a pistol on his right, which he would go with right-handed, and then he had a taser on his left side, sort of as a side holster,
mm-hmm.
and he would reach with his right hand, and they both had, you know, similar handles, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of, you know, so it seemed to me there was a real mix there of this, the idea of the gun,
yeah.
and the camera, so you can see these two amendments sort of, you know, shaking out to this 2010 with all this high technology stuff of a battle, if you will, about the use of these two modern tools, which being the camera and a gun. Well, you know, the victim takes a photograph of the cop.
That has got to be a haunting image.
And, you know, I don't know. You know, he's an arrogant little young kid. What the hell? Put that damn camera away. I mean, I've realized that, you know, the cameras do annoy police officers. Being a photographer, I'm aware of that. And I can understand it. You know, they don't, look, I'm doing my job, and, you know, it's messy. You know, you never know what I might look pretty embarrassing.
Oh, well.
I'm not going to go ahead.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. Can you imagine being the parents of Oscar Grant and having that last picture their son took before he died being the picture on his cell phone of the officer that accidentally or purposefully, either way, whatever, shot him. And
the officer, you know, in his
horrible
defense,
mm-hmm.
has profusely apologized.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, that I made a mistake. I went to get the wrong thing. You know, had he tased him, you know, he probably would have survived. But you know, he says he apologized to the family, And I'm sure he's sincere. You know, maybe he did actually get the wrong tool from his belt. It just has so many sort of interesting human questions about, you know, what tool here. You give a lot of rope to people who have one particular tool because, you know, the NRA, which was started after the Civil War by two Civil War veterans, and their purpose was to, you know, to teach people the use of firearms and to sort of, you know, spread the use of firearms. So the NRA and what is known as the gun culture sort of started at the point of the Civil War and afterwards. And at the same time, you have the tools, if you will, of the First Amendment, which at the point now, I mean, if you look at the Constitution as a battle between the standing army of George Washington and the militias of people like Jefferson, the standing army trumped everything then. I mean, the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion were by militias, and they were immediately crushed.
Mm-hmm.
So the standing army has always trumped militias. And, you know, the government has always regulated guns, even at the point of the Constitution, depending on how they wanted to. So my point is that why now are they so fearful of the tool sort of connected to the First Amendment, and it has to do with General Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex and basically the immense that we have in this imperial nation that we now live in, and of course the camera. You look at Abu Ghraib. The camera is the check to that. It's the way in. It's the way to reveal information in an out of control regime of secrecy. And so, you know, those who are delegated in the Supreme Court and other courts to keep, if you will, the status quo going.
Right.
You have to control those cameras and things.
Well, I wonder.
That's sort of a theme.
And then you go into the, take into who is the real journalist. And, I think there is this thing. Like I said, the parents of Oscar Grant having his cell phone, the last image, the cop shot him. These people in the subway cars or whatever you call them, filming through the window. And I guess I didn't know this, but the George Polk Award in journalism went to an anonymous.
Right. Well, this theme sort of developed. I was riding in the car and I heard about the George Polk Award of this year. Now I'm aware of in journalism, the George Polk Award is a pretty prestigious thing.
Right.
And so they gave the award this year to the anonymous videographer of that shot the death of a woman, a very attractive woman, on a demonstration in Tehran, Iran, who was apparently shot in the head by some sort of government sniper. And a very moving picture of this woman, bleeding from her head, bleeding to death on the road. And, very sensational, very powerful stuff. And then it, of course, got onto the Internet. And a major American Western journalism award is given to this anonymous nobody with a camera,
who just happens to
have a modern Internet connection.
Right.
And of course, we have to be aware that there's political reasons for this. Obviously, if this happened to the United States, it's not going to, unfortunately, probably not going to get the George Polk Award.
Right.
Because we hate Iran. We're officially supposed to hate Iran. So, this works in our, an established sort of system of good guys and bad guys. But I guess what I got out of that is that, well, wait a minute. I mean, how many demonstrations in this country are covered by people just like that. Mm-hmm. Like the picture I ran with my story of the riots after the Oscar Grant killing. This is the riots at the point that the police officer's charges are dropped from second-degree murder to involuntary manslaughter. So there were a lot of demonstrations that were unhappy with that. And here's a picture of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cops, and one of them, they're all in the Darth Vader outfits. They're slamming this guy to the ground, a young black man, and he's got this, you know, rather large video camera in one hand. And it seemed to me that, well, why would a guy carry such a large video camera unless, you know, he was there to record this thing?
Well, yeah, and
it's a rather cumbersome camera, you know. It's you know, it's not a weapon. It's clearly a camera. But, you know, then they probably arrested him afterwards. So, you know, what's going on here? You know, this guy is a journalist. He, you know, he's clearly probably doesn't work for the ABC affiliate in Oakland. You know, he probably does work for some, you know, independent small newspaper.
Right.
But video alternative press kind of video, which is, of course, not unlike, you know, the original 4-page newspapers pressed back in 1787. So anyway, those
well, right. Well, yeah, it's a great story. And readers, again, this can't be happening.net, and the photograph is, I'm looking at it right now. It's a guy, an African-American, maybe, holding a very large video camera, and they're knocking him down, the Oakland Police Department. No way around it. And you say it's from a recent demonstration in Oakland following the manslaughter.
Right.
This guy, the cop, was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, I guess.
Right.
And the sentence is, I guess, no more than 2 to 5 years, I think.
I'm not sure if it's a prison sentence. I haven't quite ascertained that yet.
Yeah, right. But the penalty, I think, for the charge is 2 to 5 years.
Involuntary manslaughter is a modest charge, you know, going down from second-degree murder.
But
still, you got to say, in California, that is still a first. Apparently, no police officer has ever been convicted of killing someone.
Can't we just get along?
Yeah.
Who said that? I mean, it was Rodney King.
Rodney King, yeah.
Listeners, some of you guys remember.
The hell out of him, yeah, for like 20 minutes.
Right, and I wondered, I guess they didn't go to jail for that, huh?
No, I guess that was, of course, that was another video camera. You know, someone with a video camera, as in Abu Ghraib, someone with a video camera who had, you know, gotten video that had they seen him taking that, you know, they would have interceded with him.
You know, they'd say in Police Academy movie Part 10, they would probably say something like, well, why would this Oakland cop, this BART cop, Bay Area Rapid Transit cop, stand so close on top of his so-called perpetrator, if you can imagine leaning against whatever a perpetrator is now, and being that close and trying to pull out anything, a gun or a taser or anything? I happen to know from my contact with a lot of law enforcement that that's the worst thing that can happen is for a perpetrator to grab your gun while you're and to do that close to somebody. At the very least, the guy should probably do prison time just for violating their own training protocol. I hate to be that mean, but the fact of it is like, why the hell would he pull any weapon when he's laying on top of or leaning on top of a guy who's struggling around, flailing around, looking for anything? It's just. Another thing, they were arresting three at once. Two officers, I guess, were arresting three.
I think there was a third officer standing off to the side.
Yeah, they probably called him in. But the fact of the matter is that when you get that close, you shouldn't be. It's sort of pathetic that the police officers
would do this, and it's turned into such a huge social, well, it's turned into a statement on the whole society, you know, because it's the, here, and then a journalist. Now let's step back into this a little bit. You know, what happened in the old days when the cop, when you could do the police beat? You know what a police beat is, Mr.
Sure,
Grant?
I
sure.
I do it on a newspaper every one day a week. I go up and talk to the cops about, you know, who got arrested for burglary and whatnot.
So what, I mean, you don't think, I guess nowadays, out here in Kansas, it's still possible to do that. I could call up the county sheriff's department, visit with the detectives, get off the record stuff, on the record stuff, depending on, you know, what they want to give me.
I think that's certainly still done. And, you know, there are police reporters certainly here at the Philadelphia Inquirer who, you know, it's like embedded with the units in a war. I mean, you have to have access, and so you know these cops, and, you know, they're nothing wrong with that.
But you think the problem is the police can't handle everyone being a journalist?
Well, I think that what's going on is that the police are, you know, as individual officers and units, you know, are delegated to control First Amendment activity in the case of demonstrations and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, they then become, you know, a player in the demonstration, sort of in the expression, the First Amendment expression. I know that we have demonstrations here. The local civil affairs captain, you know, very guy, nice guy, I know him, insists on leading the demonstration.
Oh, really?
You know, I mean, this isn't your demonstration. You can be here. But he always insists. It's a symbol of control. You know, he's there, and so, you know, so they're put in this position. So there is some, you know, some animosity towards him, and of course, when something happens, you know, they want really rigid control because they're afraid of losing control. We can understand that. So that they really begin over time to clamp down. And what we see, you know, and here on the East Coast especially, but obviously on the West Coast, you know, we have the most ludicrous thing is the sort of the pens that they have, the idea of, you know, cattle pens where they control you, where they have these huge arrays of metal cattle pens to control crowds. And the ultimate farce was here, because you first saw it at the Republican convention here in 2000, where they had a place that had a sign that said First Amendment Zone. You know, the
First Amendment Zone.
For, you know, this, you could, in other words, you were here put in this out of the way
right.
Whole pen, and you could say anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you weren't for anybody that it would count.
Right.
You know, so you were controlled. You were like cattle. Well, you know, that's gone on for many years, and certainly in the recent demonstrations against the wars, and you know, so I can understand all sides here, but I guess when it comes to controlling demonstrations, you know, there is some resentment of the police, and especially being a photographer, I'm always. That's one of the things that is, you know, going on, so I'm kind of inclined to photograph that.
Well,
and then the police officers see you focusing on them, and they may not even want to be there, you know, some cop.
Right.
And, you know, so suddenly it's like, wait, get out of my face, and so it becomes a more of a personal thing, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, first you sort of say it's a silly comparison, but listeners, think about this. I know some of you out there listening to this, I know some of you talk to me about it, taking guns to demonstrations. Now, I know many people, there are some people out here, some guys, friends of mine, who think we should go have demonstrations and take guns to demonstrations. Well, folks, if you follow the news as closely as I do, They were doing that, and but unfortunately, it was at a rally about President Obama, where they were calling him a Nazi and a socialist and a half-breed Muslim and all kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were carrying guns, strapped. I guess they were Glocks, what you said. And
but they were
carrying semi-automatic pistols, that's for sure. And they were slamming, and there were no cops arresting him. And these guys were walking around, I think, with a camera crew. One guy had a video crew behind him, a guy with a video camera, following him around outside a rally where Obama was appearing near there in that area, in that neighborhood, let's say. But that is a contradiction, isn't it? These guys are all white too. You know that.
Look at the obverse. You know, look at the say 10 African Americans with strapped guns on coming to an abortion demonstration or something. Some right wing demonstration. You know, that's gonna. I mean, people are gonna flip out because they're black. I hate to say it.
No.
My wife worked at a middle school. And, you know, she was a sensitive liberal person. And a couple times they would call her as an emergency person to come and intercede with, the coach who was having a problem with, a 15-year-old black boy who's just acting like a 15-year-old boy. You know, he's a jerk.
Right.
You know, it's like suddenly because he's a black boy, it becomes dangerous and almost criminal. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
By seen by this white coach. And so Luann would come and say, well, no, look, he's just being a jerk. He's a kid. Relax, you know? And so there, you know, in certain white cultures, white elements, you know, normal, obnoxious, youthful behavior is when it's with a black person is seen as
threatening.
Dangerous, you know, yeah. Threatening. You know?
Yeah, it's a... Yeah, well, I'll give you another. You know, so this is going into, it is an amazing, it's an amazing article. I really like that. I mean, I read this and I was really like, this really made me think. It took me back to some times, ironically, where I was holding a video camera or one of my cohorts outside of a abortion clinic, and I had access to the property. I was an agent representing the medical personnel within the property, and I would stand out there, and there was I did that for 10 years, and I'll tell you something interesting. I always had this, they were shooting abortion doctors in Florida and New York, and I was thinking, how many of these people outside in their religious hysteria, their states of hysteria they were in, wouldn't have a gun under their coat, and while I'm filming them, they pull out a gun and start shooting people, as happened in Brookside up there on the East Coast. Happened repeatedly with people, and you get to thinking like a cop. In terms of protecting your ass and when what advantage they have, and then I realized that as long as there's a video camera running. Or a bunch of guys with cameras, a bunch of people with cameras. If they were wanting to do it and get away with it, they probably weren't going to do it. In a way, the camera was sort of our gun at that point.
Yeah, well, it certainly protects you. Yeah,
because it was gathering evidence that could later be used. Unfortunately, you might be injured or killed after the fact. But the fact of it is that there is a fear of the camera, even from people who aren't cops, who are not cops. You know what I mean? And people who are plotting... harm on people who are otherwise defenseless. It's sort of a interesting thing. Where are you thinking of going with this? What are you working on today? I mean, this is again. If this can't be happening.net, and this is
I'm not sure where it's going. I have a couple days to do it, but I'm working on a piece. On General James Mattis, the newly appointed commander, four-star Marine commander of Central Command, which is Iraq, Afghanistan. That's David Petraeus's old job. This was a guy that was passed over for the Marine Corps commandant. He thought his career was done, and suddenly they they gave him this job. Well, he's a very colorful guy, and there's a little industry in the internet of his quotes, and some of his quotes are, you know, pretty amazing. I can't find one. My favorite is, you heard it. Be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet.
Sick.
In other words, wherever you go, you know, be polite, diplomatic, but the first thing, just figure out how you'd kill that person if you have to. You know?
Unless otherwise directed.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was talking to Chuck Young, Charles M. Young, who also writes in the same collective listeners at thiscan'tbehappening.net, and I wrongfully brought up unless otherwise directed, asking him what is Unidor mean, Unidor or whatever. And he says, Mike, I think you got that wrong. And I started looking back. It was you. You. It was you. What is? Could you? We got a few. What is that?
Let me go back.
Yeah, sure.
Before. Unless otherwise what? Directed.
Right. Yeah.
Unidor. It's one of the masters of Unidor was, of course, Cheney, who was basically the de facto president under George Bush. And the idea of unless otherwise directed is somebody like that. Basically goes in and sets all the ducks up, gets this in order, this and that, and sort of begins the whole program. The whole program is sort of started, and it's sort of, you know, 10% on the way. You know, the wheels are going, and then you inform your boss that unless otherwise directed, I'm going to continue my invasion of Iraq, you know, something like that, you know. I'm kidding with that.
Right.
And so the other master of Unidor was, you know, is General David Petraeus, who, as we all know, walks on water.
Yes, and is going to be president someday.
Yeah. He says certainly not young to know, but his name has always floated. My brother, who's an attorney in Naples, Florida, who's rather conservative, he liked the idea. He says, "Yeah, I think that's what we need. We need a military man."
Oh my God! It's just like court the coup. Let's court the coup. Well, he'll feel safe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you're right.
Maybe he needs to come to a few demonstrations. Well, this is to the Jefferson County Detectives Bureau, as small as it is here in Kansas. Gentlemen, entertain bringing your camera, your camcorder, versus your guns the next time in the rare event that there is a demonstration in North Jefferson County, Kansas. And all of us, I assure you, will be carrying our cell phones with our cameras, and we'll just film the whole incident. Hopefully,
well, you know, the police here, the civil affairs unit, I know the captain.
Right.
They always have a cameraman. So they do that. Yeah, they always have. And, you know, we joke around and we wave. We film them. They film us. And of course, you know, these guys are filming the arrest. Nobody's arresting them when, you know, the arrests are happening.
Right.
You know, so, you know, they get their First Amendment rights.
Well, maybe if this is a balancing act that in the end will come out. But I'll tell you one thing for sure. There's nothing worse than pulling out guns in a demonstration. It's like a circular firing squad. I've seen that. That's a terrible thing. And go ahead.
I'm a gun owner.
Yeah.
I'm a gun owner, and I'm also a devotee of Gandhi's Satyagraha, you know, the idea of the truth force and you know, speaking truth to power, and it's absolutely insanity to even think about bringing a gun to a demonstration.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
It is amazing where we're at today in the 21st century, how far we've come, isn't it? Well, John, thank you for coming on Radio Free Kansas. We're going to have you back on again, or one of your co-conspirators at thiscan'tbehappening.net. This is a great website. It's off to a great start, and Those of you who follow the Fightin' Cock Flyer, that irreverent blog I run, I try to post whenever they hit it. But I want to tell you, on the East Coast, this is it. It's a coin toss between Consortium News and this can't be happening on all of us who pay attention to Counterpunch. This is the East Coast version. If you know, you all, many of you are familiar with Counterpunch. You got to check out this this real dynamo of real cool journalism going on, an experiment in out of Pennsylvania, thiscan'tbehappening.net, with John Grant, Chuck Young, Dave Lindorf, who you may be hearing more of today, and Lynn Washington, who writes a great piece for the, usually around the city of Philadelphia.
Right, yeah. He's from South Africa, waiting for the last piece.
Yeah, nice. Oh, really? Yeah. Well, he'll probably be next in line. Listeners, I'll get him on. Thank you, John. Hold on.
Mike, thank you.
I'm seeing it for the worker, I'm seeing it for the land, I'm seeing it make a difference.
Jim Herman, and thanks a lot, Jim, for letting me play your stuff on Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. If you'd like to send me an email anytime, feel free at all one word, Blue Barn News Central. That's bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. Coming up next is Kevin McDermott Rowe's incredible series of programs called History Counts. I've listened to a bunch of them. You're going to listen to a series of these, some of his older shows. I was going through his archives, and I found that he interviewed Michael Christopher Carroll, the author of the book Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Plum Island Germ Warfare Laboratory. This is it's published. It's still this book is still available. Just Google it. It's available on Amazon, Google Books. Significant portions of it are reprinted for your reading availability at Google Books. Google Books Lab 257, and you can get sections of his book, Michael Carroll's book. Here's some advanced praise. It came on the release of the book, Nelson DeMille, who a detective novelist, fiction author of Plum Island and Upcountry, he wrote, "If you lost sleep reading in the hot zone, then Michael Christopher Carroll's Lab 257 will keep you awake all night. It's one of the best of investigative reporting you'll read this year. Lab 257 is must reading for the post 9/11 world." Also, former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, wrote, "If we're lucky, someone in the media will read this carefully researched, chilling expose of a potential catastrophe and force the government to do something about it. If not, Mike Carroll's brilliant work will have been wasted and will be the victims once again of government inadvertence." Again, that's from Mario Cuomo, former governor of New York. And Lyle Weicker Jr., I don't remember him. He's a former senator and governor of Connecticut. Plum Island is located right approximately in the ocean between Connecticut and New York. You'll hear more about it. Lowell Weicker, he writes, "Lab 257 proves that scientific fact on Plum Island can indeed be stranger than science fiction. Mike Carroll has the uncanny ability to transport the reader inside the frightening world of Plum Island." You may hear about this. The reason I'm playing this, I dug this up. It was an interview conducted several years ago. Well, it was on History Counts. I'm real happy that I found it for Kansas listeners in particular, because we're going to be having approval of across the political aisle. Every member of Congress, our congressional delegation, former Governor Kathleen Sebelius, everybody in power in Kansas, in political elected political power and in vested financial interests, heavily vested financial interests, people, the elites of Kansas have unanimously supported the movement of a biological level 4 facility being constructed at the campus of Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas, NBAF. NBAF stands for National Biological Agro Defense Facility. It's a germ warfare research lab, folks. Wide throwing bull in the air. It's straight shooting. Right smack dab in the middle of cow country. Unbelievable. Well, and there's many of the scientists and people who have vested financial interests in the state of Kansas will not tell you about this stuff. They don't want you to know, other than it's going to be safe. Will you be the judge? Listen to this rare interview with Michael Carroll about Plum Island before it moves to Manhattan, Kansas. When's 30 minutes? We'll take calls in the last half hour, play some more Jim Herman and other regional musicians. Enjoy Radio Free Kansas.
Welcome to History Counts. History provides the roadmap to the future. If you want to know where you're going, you have to understand where you've been. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Plum Island Animal Disease Center is a government research facility located just 2 miles off the coast of Long Island, New York. Since the beginning of the Cold War, scientists at Plum Island have been conducting experiments with the world's deadliest viruses. What is the purpose of these experiments, and have they endangered the general population? Please stay tuned as we put the spotlight on the United States government's activities at Plum Island in this edition of History Counts. You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we're going to take a close look at the United States government's Animal Disease Center at Plum Island. What is the government doing there? Is Plum Island responsible for the spread of Lyme disease and other illnesses? To help us answer these questions, we're very fortunate to have as our guest Michael Christopher Carroll, author of Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Germ Laboratory. Mr. Carroll graduated from the American University in Washington, D.C., and went on to receive his law degree from St. John's University in New York City, where he was editor of a law review. Mr. Carroll devoted 7 years to researching the government's activities at Plum Island, and he now practices law in California. Mr. Carroll, thanks very much for being with us today. Where is Plum Island, and why should people be concerned about the government's activities there?
Plum Island, Ken, is situated about just under 2 miles off the east end of Long Island off Orient Point, and about 10 or 11 or so miles south from the coast of Connecticut along the Sound. It's about an 840-acre pork chop-shaped island. And on this island, really for the last past half century, some of the most dangerous pathogens, viruses and bacteria known to man, are researched in a laboratory that is really no better equipped to, in terms of safety, in terms of biohazard, and in terms of security, than a junior high school biology laboratory. Yet it contains some of the most dangerous germs known to mankind.
Now, it's called an animal center. Are some of these diseases contagious to humans?
Every time I respond, it's hard for me to hold back my feelings of disgust when it comes to the way that the our friends at the U.S. Department of Agriculture have described this laboratory for the past 50-some years as an animal disease laboratory, because folks like you and I and your listeners would normally think, well, that sounds pretty harmless to me. They're just dealing with animal diseases. Unfortunately for all of us, a place like Plum Island, a, quote, animal disease laboratory, works on diseases, really, again, viruses and some bacteria, that affect not only the animals that we know as animals, but also the human animal as well. And many of these diseases are what's called zoonotic diseases, and they can be equally virulent, equally deadly to humans as well as animals. So it is correct to say that as an animal disease laboratory, it is also incredibly and highly misleading, because it gives off the impression that the work they do there cannot affect us as people, and it certainly can.
Could you give us an example of some of the viruses that are worked on there?
Sure. Probably one of the, if not the most dangerous virus there is a virus that very few people would know about unless you did the research and maybe looked online. It's called the Rift Valley Fever Virus. This virus is a it's called a VHF, or a viral hemorrhagic fever virus. I like to call it and refer to it as the sort of first cousin of the Ebola virus. It's one of these hemorrhagic bleeding fever diseases that actually killed over 1,000 people in Egypt in the late 70s during an epidemic there near the Aswan River Dam. And it does affect animals and livestock, of course. But it does have terrible, terrible consequences for human beings. It's transmitted by mosquitoes, and they have large quantities of it in you know, virtually unguarded conditions on Plum Island. Some of the other diseases include African swine fever virus, Japanese encephalitis virus, which is an encephalitis virus similar to West Nile virus, foot and mouth disease, equine encephalitis virus, and really a host of other diseases that affect animals, quote unquote, primarily, but in fact also affect humans as well.
Now, Lab 257, mentioned in the title of your book, refers to one of the labs on Plum Island?
That's right. Lab 257 is the earliest laboratory on the island, and it was actually the property of and instituted by the U.S. Army as a germ warfare laboratory.
Now, in your book, Lab 257, you show that the origins of the Plum Island facility is closely connected to the work of Dr. Eric Traub. Can you talk about Dr. Traub's career and how he eventually became involved in Plum Island?
Eric Traub, this sort of unseemly character that melted into the depths of history and unknown before the book came out. While I was conducting research at the National Archives and Records Administration in College Park, Maryland, I came upon him basically in a file that had not been opened since it was put there in the 50s and later declassified. Eric Traub was part of what was called Project Paperclip, that you or maybe the listeners have heard of, where the United States government, after World War II, secretly essentially smuggled or imported Nazi scientists and engineers to the United States to help the United States conduct the early phases of the Cold War against, of course, Soviet Russia and China. What the little-known part of some of these things is that the people that were brought over here, the German Nazis that were brought over here, had some pretty unseemly records and pasts and, that were conveniently overlooked, and some of them evaded forums like the Nuremberg trials, where arguably some of them deserved to have been tried in the effort to help the United States during the Cold War. So Eric Traub was the top germ warfare scientist during World War II. He reported directly to Heinrich Himmler, the Reichsfuhrer of the SS, and he conducted actually on his own island, which of course was the genesis for the idea to create an offshore island in the United States. He had his own island called Insel Reims in the Baltic Sea, and Traub conducted a number of tests involving food, germ warfare against basically livestock, farm animals, with the idea of starving in this case it would be the Allies, as enemies of their food population. So he conducted a whole series of tests, and what the documents talked about was the Eastern Front. Of course, the Nazi, the German Eastern Front was occupied Russia at the time, and he had a number of trials and germ sprayer trials that they conducted with his handiwork. And after World War II, he was put to work for the Soviets at gunpoint. He was able to escape with his family into West Berlin, and we took him to the United States, and he came with the idea of setting an offensive germ warfare against animals and food population island where research could be conducted ostensibly safely, and that became what we know today as Plum Island.
This wasn't his first time in the United States, though. I understand from your book that in the 1930s, he worked at the Rockefeller Institute in Princeton on viruses.
That's right. Traub spent a good period of time, as actually many Germans did prior to the outbreak of hostilities, in the United States with friends and colleagues, scientific colleagues in the United States, and on the eve of the war returned. But he one of the most fascinating and overlooked pieces to Dr. Traub's shrouded history is that, as you say, he was a student of one of the most prestigious and, again, one of the most secretive organizations, the Rockefeller Institute, and later today Rockefeller University on York Avenue in Manhattan. And he actually was trained there, and he was trained with some of the people that basically taught him his craft, and then he returned to Germany.
So he comes to the United States, and he's involved in work for the USDA, you're right, the Naval Medical Research Institute, Fort Detrick, the American Biowar Headquarters, and developing weapons-grade viruses. And then he is offered the chief job at Plum Island.
That That's correct. Had he taken it, we'd probably be in a different situation today. Certainly his tenure and his identity would have been made more public. Given the treatment of his counterpart in the rocketry field, Wernher von Braun, and the way that he was sort of celebrated throughout the 50s and the host of Disneyland Tomorrowland, exhibits and television shows, and still has a civic center named for him in Huntsville, Alabama, when he, basically overran and oversaw slave labor camps to build V-2 rockets and was a member of the SS. We may know a little more about Traub, but no, indeed, Traub, I would imagine rather smartly from his point of view, declined the initial chairmanship and directorship of the Plum Island Laboratory, and he just sort of stayed in the background.
But he eventually became head of a new biowar facility in Germany, but he did visit Plum Island, right?
That's right. That's right. He was the distinguished scientist visitor often at Plum Island. He became a scientist at a director at a laboratory that was established in West Germany, and then sort of later just ended his tenure under some financial disgrace involving some funds and really some kind of an accounting or financial scandal. He actually had to resign from his position at that laboratory in West Germany.
Now, in your book, you place Dr. Traub in the context of the U.S. biowar program. Well, in 1951, the U.S. military's Joint Chiefs determined that, quote, the destruction of the enemy's food supply by the use of anti-animal biological warfare agents would be strategic. Immediate action should be taken to procure an island test site where all types of hot agents could be tested, end quote. This is what leads us to Plum Island.
It is. It was the idea, very interesting idea, of which there were many in that early Cold War period for brainstorming, and a lot of very amazing things came to be in that period, many of which we live with today, Plum Island being one of them, and the germ warfare program being a larger part and a subset being Plum Island. But yes, the goal of the Joint Chiefs and the goal of the military, which was to figure out a way to use biological warfare, not against, they also had a human program, but in this instance, what Plum Island became, the offshore offensive germ warfare laboratory, designed not actually for humans, although many of these pathogens do affect and can kill humans, but to work on weaponized viruses and bacteria that could decimate the enemy's food population. So they had some fascinating research that they did. The estimates that they did in cooperation with the early CIA in terms of how many calories a Russian farm worker needed to live off, a Russian a secretary in an office, a paratrooper, and what would happen if we wiped out the swine and the cattle livestock in the country and how it would create a starvation scenario. The whole reason, of course, being to force a surrender of the enemy in China or Soviet Russia, and then the outcome being they would simply have the physical plant structure left of the enemy intact, which was a sort of an ingenious view that they would basically wipe out the people but without and get them to capitulate without having to destroy physical structures and plant that they could then use, the U.S. could use in a victory scenario or in an occupation scenario where they couldn't use physical plants they had destroyed, for example, the firebombing of Berlin and the atomic weaponry used against Japan.
So as I understand the process, viruses are brought from off Plum Island to Plum Island, and they're grown in laboratories. They are used to infect cells, and then the infected cells have been injected into test animals on Plum Island, and the scientists observe the results.
Exactly. That's sort of a abridged version of the type of testing that goes on at Plum Island. There's a large amount of domesticated farm animals that are used as test subjects. Sometimes it's even marine life that are used. And exactly, there are pens. There are sort of test rooms that are supposed to be sealed to other test rooms, and then a laboratory that's supposed to be contained to the outside world. The air inside, the infected air, if you will, and that's exactly how the tests are worked on. I mean, there'll be samples of some of these pathogens. They'll infect healthy animals and work on them and to see what happens with the diseases as they progress through the animals. And then secondly, often the testing of tissue samples and infected animals themselves, pieces of them, if you will, are taken into the laboratory, flown in from all parts of the world, wherein Plum Island is the only place, or ostensibly the only place in the United States, where exotic diseases that primarily affect animals can be studied and not on the mainland of the United States.
Well, you cite evidence that germs from Plum Island may have been used by the U.S. in offensive military operations, Cuba in 1971, for example. The main thrust of your book is the accidental release of disease germs into the outside world. In particular, you refer to, quote, the insidious connection, end quote, between Plum Island and the outbreak of various infectious diseases, including Lyme disease and West Nile fever. I'd like to focus on Lyme disease. For those in our audience who are not familiar with Lyme disease, could you explain how it affects the human body?
It's a bacteria. It's called Borrelia burgdorferi. It's a strain of bacteria that is new to the world, but it is a part of a Borrelia family bacteria, a bacteria that was found bacteria that existed at least at some point in Europe and did not find itself on the soil of the United States until the mid-70s in Old Lyme, Connecticut, when a mysterious outbreak occurred where 23 or so, young children in the town of Old Lyme, Connecticut, came down with rheumatoid arthritic conditions, and there was an initial diagnosis of some kind of a juvenile arthritis, and it was later found out to be a completely unique bacteria called Borrelia, and then it was named after the scientist that identified it, Wally Burgdorfer, was in a lab in Colorado, actually, as the strain being Borrelia burgdorferi. It has a number of different from my understanding, not being, again, I'm not a scientist, but I know enough, that it really, medically speaking, it wreaks absolute complete havoc, or it can, with the immune functionality of the of the body, and it can manifest itself in terrible joint pain, to headaches or sensitivity to light, and types of and sort of what makes Lyme disease, which is of course named for Old Lyme, Connecticut, where it first was uncovered, so unique, is that it can manifest itself in many ways. It can go into remission for a number of years and then just kind of come up out of nowhere, and it seems to have a lingering effect. There's no cure for Lyme disease. There was a vaccine for Lyme disease, but it was found to be ineffective, and it was a lot of controversy over that. But there's really no cure for the disease.
You're right that it appears to be an inescapable truth. Wild birds and deer contracted the Borrelia burgdorferi, the new bacteria that causes Lyme, from ticks impregnated with germs studied on Plum Island. Could you talk about the Plum Island connection?
Absolutely. You know, every investigation is about connecting the dots. At the same time that these children had come down with these strange conditions, you have to understand the geography. Old Lyme, Connecticut, lies in the mouth of the Connecticut River on the Long Island Sound, about 10 or 11 miles or so southwest of that is Plum Island that sits out there, this laboratory. And at that time in the mid-70s when this outbreak occurred, Plum Island had not one but two what they called tick colonies, where they were breeding hundreds and thousands of hard and soft ticks working on a disease called African swine fever. At the same time as this massive tick research was going on working with this African swine fever virus on pigs, essentially, the laboratory, which was hailed when it first opened in press releases as the world's safest laboratory, with all that, you know, sort of 1950s hubris that you read about often, had become so dilapidated that there were 3/4-inch holes in the laboratory's roof where the air filters were and where there used to be Rudberg gaskets that would seal the laboratory to the outside world. Well, those had cracked and wilted away in the 30 years of preventative. Well, it wasn't preventative. There was no maintenance. And these were basically documents that I had uncovered from the chief engineer of Plum Island. So we have ticks being bred and being worked on. We have a lab that is essentially porous like a sponge when it's supposed to be contained. And then you have birds. You have an avian flight path of literally hundreds of thousands of birds that fly the North American flyway. And they stop there and at the end of Long Island and Gardner's Island and Fisher's Island and Plum Island, and then they fly over to the shore of Connecticut, and many of them fly into the mouth of the Connecticut River. Now, is it conceivable that a tick could have gotten on someone's lab coat and they could have walked out, the tick could have fallen off as the person was walking on the island to over to the ferry to get back to the mainland, and then that tick essentially got into the bird that then, you know, crossed the sound? Absolutely. I mean, that's basically vectors. That's how diseases spread. That's how Lyme disease spread through the entire United States. And that's exactly how West Nile virus has spread through the practically the entire United States. And question then we get is, well, why African swine fever virus? That's not Lyme disease. And, of course, that's true. But what we need to know, Ken, and what the listeners need to understand is that when the things that were being tested on in the 70s at that point in the tick colony had to do with infected pigs and tissue samples of already infected animals that were coming in from all parts of the world, from these different, you know, period Europe or Malaysia or deep Africa, and they were brought into this island to be studied. So it's absolutely feasible that this stuff could have been cross-contaminated. It might have been a pig that showed signs of African swine fever or cattle, what have you, with a different disease, and then it could have been cross-contaminated with a whole host of bacteria. Given all those facts, it's contemptible that there was never once a finger pointed or a question of whether, officially speaking, whether Plum Island needed to be investigated as the source of the outbreak of Lyme disease.
And you discovered a 1978 USDA memo indicating that on Plum Island there were experiments with giving viruses to the Lone Star and Cayenne ticks, which were then tested on pigs in 75. The same year that the Lyme disease first appeared. So there is documentation.
Oh, sure. I mean, the Lone Star tick, and, you know, most people know the deer tick because, you know, sort of has had an affinity for deer, but the Lone Star tick, just the same, they're sort of the two ticks that are culprits in the spread of the Lyme disease bacteria. And sure enough, they were working with plenty of those types of ticks at that same exact time.
And there's also the matter of the deer, because they're only 2 miles from Plum Island to the shore of Long Island. The deer can make that swim to Plum Island.
There were many, many deer that inhabited Plum Island, and like you said, yeah, they would swim. Very little known fact, they could swim a few miles, and deer, basically swam to and fro Gardner's Island, Plum Island, and the Orient Point there, and they very easily, a tick could have found its way burrowed into a deer. And the deer could have come to Long Island or one of the other islands, and it could have been transmitted to a bird at that point.
So once the deer, for example, had been infected with a tick from Plum Island, any other tick biting into that deer would then become infected?
That's right. That's right. I mean, and then you have all manner of vermin, anyone trying to either attack the deer or vice versa, the deer maybe trying to, you know, sniff around or play with a bird that had died.
Now, if we could talk for a moment about the West Nile virus, which appeared in the summer of 1999, could you talk about the symptoms, the consequences of that disease?
West Nile virus causes what's called an encephalitis, which is a swelling of the fluid in the brain. And if not properly treated, which it can be, certain agents can be used to reduce that swelling, the brain will literally shut down and almost implode because of the massive pressure being put on it by the swelling of and the expansion of this fluid. It's transmitted by the mosquito.
And you say that in the New York City outbreak in the summer of 1999, there were 200,000 cases and almost 400 people died. So it was quite a significant outbreak. There isn't. Is there a cure for West Nile virus?
No, there's not.
And you have a source on Plum Island who named as Jim House, who said that West Nile virus was being studied there before 1999, and that Plum Island is the only site where animal germs like West Nile virus are supposed to be studied.
Yeah, they haven't officially come out and said that we studied it there, but, you know, as I stated in the book, I mean, some people have said that they did and recalled that they did, and at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's sort of the only place where, if it's the only place where exotic, non-indigenous animal diseases should be studied, then you would think that they would have some West Nile virus in their freezers there.
What do you think needs to be done to establish definitively the connection between the outbreak of Lyme disease and diseases like West Nile virus and Plum Island?
I think that we need to have sort of an open understanding that the facts when it relates to West Nile virus and when it relates to Lyme disease need to be recognized for what they are. And instead of kind of putting their heads in the sand and saying, there's no way it could have came from Plum Island, it's impossible because of X or Y or Z, none of which really hold up under scrutiny, how about possibly investigating? How about possibly taking a scientifically trained eye and saying, is it possible that these things could have emanated from that island, an island that you know, has more mishaps than you can count, an island that had an outbreak that they finally acknowledged? It was actually referred to only as an incident until about 2 or 3 weeks ago. This was from 1978, and just 2 or 3 weeks ago, the USDA finally acknowledged to a congressional subcommittee that it was indeed an outbreak of foot and mouth disease that came out of the laboratory and infected animals that were clean, if you will, or non-infected in test holding pens on the island. So I think we need investigation. I think we need, I think we need public disclosure. I think that unfortunately people are so entrenched in the scientific community when it comes to this place, Plum Island, they're just more concerned about, you know, their entrenched positions than they are about the truth.
Mr. Carroll, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about the United States government's Animal Disease Center at Plum Island with Michael Christopher Carroll, author of Lab 257, The Disturbing Story of the Government's Secret Germ Laboratory. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'll be right back. The Center for Disease Control reports that from 1991 to 2006, there were approximately 250,000 new cases of Lyme disease in the United States. Although concentrated in the Northeast, Lyme disease has spread to 49 of the 50 states. In 1972, the United States signed an international convention prohibiting the development and production of biological weapons and requiring the destruction of existing stockpiles of such weapons within 9 months. The convention took effect in 1975, the year that Lyme disease first appeared. Thank you for joining us. History Counts is broadcast on the first Thursday of the month at 12:30 p.m. and on the first Sunday of the month at 10 p.m. It's produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and engineered by David Schwartz. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.
And thank you, Ken McDermott Rowe, for letting me broadcast that. It's a wonderful show. You'll be hearing more. You'll be hearing more of History Counts in future episodes of Radio Free Kansas. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to read just a couple paragraphs from NoNBAF in Kansas. It's a website that's available for everybody to look. It's not really being kept up to date. It's been since the approval of by the Department of Homeland Security, since they approved it to be constructed. I don't know. There have been a few snags, but it sure seems like they're coming in here under the guise of providing jobs, of building this thing at the campus of Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. And the reality, under second entry from the top of the scroll, was put on September 11, 2009. And it was a very interesting, really interesting. Kansas wind can carry aerosols, foot and mouth virus 30 miles. An infected hog can exhale 400 million viruses a day. It takes as few as 10 virus particles to infect an animal. Here's just a reality check. Attached, they have seven pictures showing large numbers of vector animals within a mile of KSU's NBAF site. What if imagine what would happen if an accidental release coincided with perhaps all university open house or a K-State Nebraska football game. How would you guarantee the surrounding area to be protected? An accident doesn't have to happen on the hour, but within the period of days before the release is recognized. With sheep, that could be 10 to 15 days. The Kansas State University sheep pastures are used as overflow parking lots on big game days, and they're just catty-cornered from the proposed site. One of the several accidental foot-and-mouth disease releases at the English site, Pirbright, that's P-I-R-B-R-I-G-H-T, level 4 lab, that's in England, started when a tree root caused a leak in a lab sewer pipe, and a truck carried the contaminated mud to neighboring farms. And Kansas State University, the writer points out, at no NBAF in Kansas. Kansas State University already has a $250 million backlog of deferred maintenance. Tornado, for that matter, severe straight-line winds don't have to cause structural damage to disrupt the air pressure balance inside the laboratories. It only has to overwhelm the rubber airlock gaskets or air filter seals around garage-sized doors needed to bring in hay and other feed. Improbable as it may be, the prospect of an earthquake has the Corps of Engineers spending millions of dollars currently to stabilize Tuttle Creek Dam, a geologically insignificant distance from NBAF. Ranchers in Raleigh and adjacent counties own about 450,000 livestock. Now picture the sheep pasture parking lot emptying with K-State University and Nebraska fans driving in all directions back to their farms. Government-funded Project Crimson calculated that a release would reach 35 states in 10 days. That was put up by Bill Dorsett, a resident of Manhattan, Kansas. I'll give you some more interesting stuff. It's an interesting site, really. It's not kept up well, and the resistance to NBAF has pretty well been neutralized. Lawsuits will be filed, I understand. That's basically the last effort to stop it from coming here in Kansas. I don't think people should give up. That community policing is probably the best thing somehow, some way, to bring these people to their senses about moving this horrible laboratory to right in the heartland of Kansas. It's insane. We'll play a little music, and we'll get back to you. I got a little bit more news to read, a recent news break on NBAF, the National Biological Agro Defense Facility opening up in Manhattan, Kansas for construction. But first, here's our featured musician, local musician, Tim Herman from Kansas City, Ohio, an old song, I guess, by him. You've heard it.
Thank you. How can you make peace with a madman living in your house? Breaking all the dishes while you sleep, you can't kick him out. You can't wash the seas or the orchard, even save your horse. How can you make peace when you ask? It only gets much worse. It always gets much worse.
Musician, you'll hear on Radio Free Kansas. I got a couple callers. You need to press one if you want to put your hand up. We're gonna go right on and play the rest. 15 minutes remaining for Radio Free Kansas with a local blues musician, long gone, but his band, The Outlets, are still around. Lawrence Wright.
Gentlemen, it's not very often where you run upon a musician that's not only loved for making great music, but also his love for being a fantastic individual. The master of disaster, the king of the B3, Kansas City's original blues man, Mr. Lawrence Wright!
Miami broadcast. Kansas City, Hot and Spicy. That's from their Hot and Spicy album. We've got a couple callers. One of them has their hand up, 913. You're on air. Would you like to talk? Say something quick. Go ahead. You're on air, 913.
Hello.
Hello. Got a quick comment before we go on to Lawrence Wright and more of the blues, Kansas City.
Yes, they capped the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, finally.
This is Mark, yep, listeners, Mark Cancel. Mark Cancel, Blog Talk Radio.
I changed my video show. I'm going to do a quick plug, and then I'll get off of that. I changed my video show for Sailing Tales from Sunday to Saturday night at 10 o'clock tonight. Due to my work schedule, I have a real job.
Oh.
So I had to change it because I work nights now at my regular job. And
okay.
So I had to change my time. But I figured Saturday night, 10 o'clock, I should be able to get a little bit more of an audience instead of Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. But anyway.
Well, either way, it's a nice break from church. I always enjoyed your time. But beginning at 10 o'clock tonight, huh?
10 o'clock tonight. A little quick comment to bring up today on the NAACP versus the Teabaggers. That is a fiasco of a drama unfolding before us. One of the co-founders of the Teabaggers obviously wrote a Abraham Lincoln era style letter to the president, Mr. Reese of the NAACP, in the sort of the nomenclature that was used back in the 1800s by the African American slaves, calling themselves us colored folk don't understand what you people are talking about being racist. You know, it was a very interesting letter that was on CNN. You can pick that up at CNN.com and view that letter in its entirety. It's very appalling. It's hard to believe that this came out of a fellow American's own mouth and handwriting, but it is. And his comment was he was trying to get their attention to come to the table and talk. Now,
that's cool. Maybe you'll talk some more about this tonight.
Tonight, on my radio show, we will be talking about the all various types of topics. We're going to be talking about the capping the oil spill in the Gulf waters. Is it really over? We're going to be talking about sailing and relationships of individuals sailing, and we're also going to be talking about the political side of what's going on in our country, which is right now the big hot topic is the NAACP versus the Teabaggers and the racism showdown, which is going to be probably taking. On Sailing Tales, I know it has not much to do with sailing, but on Sailing Tales, we're going to be talking about, and hopefully I'll get a bunch of commentaries and callers to call in and give their opinions about this and maybe some more updates on what's going on. But anyway,
prime time, 10 p.m. tonight. How do people find it? Just go to Blog Talk Radio and do what?
Blog Talk Radio and go to Sailing Tales. And it will pop right up.
There we go, folks. There we go. Back.
Something I want to tell you. This I know is true. Out of all these pretty women, baby, ain't nothing I won't do for you. After all.
Something by Canned Heat called Fried Hockey Boogie.